Welcome to ArtSpeak Radio. I'm your host, Maria Vasquez Boyd, and we've got a terrific show lined up for you today. We have wonderful guests in the studio, Hector Casanova and Renee Sinderhaus. Let me see if I can get my headphones working here, honey. I ought to plug these in. Listen, Hector Casanova and Renee Sinderhaus are here in the studio, and they're such a dynamic, creative couple. Hector is an illustrator, an artist whose work includes staff illustration for the Kansas City Star, as well as comics, including Screamland. And Hector's work also includes fine art installations and murals, as well as illustrations and comics. He is a full-time instructor in the illustration department at Kansas City Art Institute. He also works with students in the Northeast neighborhood, transforming a boarded-up school building by treating its surfaces as a giant canvas. I also want to read off a little bit about Renee Sinderhaus, who is best known for her large-scale immersive installation, mixed-media sculptures, and her narrative works in clay. She's based out of Kansas City in her studio since 1998. So I want to welcome Hector and Renee both to the studio.
Hi, Maria. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Maria. Thank you.
Terrific. This is really an exciting program for us to have you both here. Hector, you grew up in Mexico, and I'm going to begin by asking you what inspired you, what sort of influenced you to make art as a child?
Honestly, I think that that's probably the first thing that I was good at as a kid. Mm-hmm. I was an introverted kid and socially awkward, as most kids probably, you know, feel that they are.
Yeah.
But I definitely took. I had a hard time making friends and just being social, and you know, going back to preschool basically. Mm-hmm. And drawing was always sort of like my refuge, and it's the very first thing that I started getting any sort of like attention and mm-hmm. respect from other kids. So they, you know, from the time that I was like 5 years old, 6 years old, other kids were asking me to draw Batman for them. So I think that's probably where it started.
So, and let's talk about your comics, too. When did you begin drawing your comics?
Going back to that very early formative time, you know, like so many kids growing up in the late 70s and early 80s, I grew up on superheroes and, you know, morning cartoons and things like that. I was in Mexico, though. Mm-hmm. But one of the first things that, you know, I didn't really like reading, but the one thing that I always liked to read was comic books. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. in that respect, my mom was really supportive of me buying comic books because at least I was reading. She, no doubt, would have rather I've been reading, you know, The Jungle Book or something else. I wanted to be a comic book artist since I was a little kid. Ever since I was about 8 years old, I remember thinking that it just dawned me that somebody does this for a living. That's what I want to do.
Yeah. Now, I met you back at the Kansas City Art Institute. You're coming in into the illustration department, and now you're working there full-time as an instructor. Does it feel like you've gone full circle?
It is. It is a really slightly surreal, but an incredible honor because I transferred into the KCAI as a sophomore. Mm-hmm. I remember very distinctly, you know, being the first day of classes, being in a class with Professor Steve Mays.
Oh, yeah.
And just realizing that I had made the right decision, that I was at the right place. Mm-hmm. And now, all these years later, I'm teaching at KCAI, and Steve Mays, who was that teacher, is now, I don't think I could have really considered him my peer, but definitely my colleague.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, you both met at Bennington College back in the early 90s, right?
Yes.
And then that was years later, you met up again, and then you came to the Art Institute. During that time at the Art Institute, there were several internships that were available to illustration students. One, I believe, was the Walt Disney internship, and one was at the Kansas City Star, and you spent some time there at the Star.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So it was between my junior and my senior year. I got an internship at the Kansas City Star, and it was great. It was my very first, mm-hmm. professional experience, both in the sense of actually having to go into an office building looking relatively respectable. And, you know, at the time I was an art school kid and I had like, you know, a mop of like a green, like messy hair. And I, you know,
I remember purple too.
but I had to go into an office building and, and then also having the professional experience of having my work published for the first time and then seen by hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
And that was awesome and strange and intimidating and ecstatic at the time.
And from that work, you also did some freelance with The Pitch.
Yes, that's you know, basically that's what started my career. Mm-hmm. That internship did, and I worked at the Star through the summer, and then that following year, during my senior year in school, I was up and running, and I kept on doing mm-hmm. freelance work for the Star and The Pitch at that mm-hmm. point. And then a couple of years later, I ended up being hired by the Star as a full-time illustrator. In a way, it's almost like I sort of peaked early because I achieved my goal way too early in life. My goal was always to make a living by being an artist.
Sure, sure.
And I got started, you know, a couple of years out of college, and I have been doing that ever since.
And that was a terrific time for you because during your time at the Star, it was full of really creative people. I remember Tom Dolphins and Deborah Tokar and a number of people that you've met along the way. But you also had a comic in the preview section. Is that right?
Yes, I had a comic strip.
Godot and...
Yes, it was...
Guffman?
Guffman and Godot. That's what Godot. It was called. Uh-huh. Yes. And that was a really fantastic time at the Star. This was through the early 2000s, basically.
Yeah.
And yes, I mean, back at the time, the Star had a full-time, like, music, a classical music critic.
Yeah.
And TV critic and pop culture critic
mm-hmm.
and, yes,
mm-hmm.
literary critics. Like, it was fantastic going into this building and knowing that, you know, critics and scholars and some of the brightest people living in the city, we were all going to work in the same
yeah.
block. And
yeah.
everybody was just, you know, like a 30-second walk away, just kind of mm-hmm. sitting next to each other. It was really stimulating time.
Terrific. And do you do some freelance work with them from time to time now? Or because I think, didn't you leave just recently? Or am I making things up?
No, it's... I got the opportunity to start teaching at KCAI
right.
Last year. So I went down from being full-time at the Star mm-hmm. to being part-time. And now I'm basically, it feels like freelance work, mm-hmm. but it's technically I'm still a part-time mm-hmm. part of the Star. And I'm regularly doing stuff still for the Star, but it's not as intensive as it was mm-hmm. you know, before. It was 40, 50 hours a week.
Now, when you left... when you graduated from the Art Institute, had the illustration been kind of closed up shortly after that? Because it seems like it kind of went away, and then there was a slew of people who sort of, you know, renewed the illustration department and got it back up and running, and I think it changed locations too. But were you a part of that when it went away from the campus?
I was a part of the bringing it back.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember the year exactly. I think it was maybe 2008, I
mm-hmm.
believe.
Mm-hmm.
But after I graduated from KCI, you know, I had another job for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody, like, I worked at Kinko's for a while, and everybody
sure.
has to, you know, go through those motions.
Yeah.
And then I got the job at the Star. At one point at the Star, right before I turned 30, I decided that I needed to make good on my lifelong dream of making comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And if I didn't do it by the time I was 30, mm-hmm. then I should just quit thinking that it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I quit working at the Star to work in comics. And I did work in, I did a couple graphic novels.
Uh-huh.
It was around that time that I got word that the illustration department was being canceled. And I was also teaching as an adjunct at the time, so
mm-hmm,
I got to teach
mm-hmm.
the very last graduating class.
Yeah.
And then the department was basically gone for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And Steve Mays reached out to me and to Nathan Fox to get together with him, and he was determined to bring it back. And so
mm-hmm.
he wanted to redesign it from the ground up, and he asked us for help to redesign the, mm-hmm. the program, what the curriculum should be, what should be taught every year. So we got together a few weekends and kind of like basically put together a new curriculum. In my mind, that was just it felt almost like, you know, fantasy football. Like, we're just pretending. It's like, wow, we've, like, come up with the best illustration program. Yeah. What would it be?
Yeah.
And that's what it was basically a series of conversations about that. And then Steve Mays stuck with it, and he continued fighting the battles. And, a year later, maybe, a year and a half later, he sent the message that it's happening. The illustration program's coming back.
Well, and that was really smart to make you an instrumental part of that redevelopment, because you sort of had been out there and knew what worked and knew what you wanted to see the program become. So
yes, in that respect, I certainly couldn't have been given any useful input had I not already been working as long as I had been, and also been part of the program the way that it had been.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's also the fact that we are in a shifting time, obviously. You know, technology has changed the way that we do art in such a dramatic way. Mm-hmm. When I started at the Star, there were people there that had still, up until fairly recently, been doing just, you know, the old-fashioned paste-up. You know, people still wore the green visors.
Isn't that crazy? And I mean, it hasn't been that long.
No, it really hasn't.
Yeah.
You know, people are using glue sticks and, like, red line and all that stuff. And,
you know, I would have been one of those people and still do. But as far as the illustration department, some of my former colleagues are there. John Ferry,
absolutely.
Right? Steve Mays,
mm-hmm. Maura Cluthie, John Ferry, Steve Mays, and David Terrell. We are the core full time faculty, and then there's half dozen adjunct instructors as well.
Sure, I remember Brent Watkinson being one on staff with me, and Mark Bischel.
Yes.
So they still do a lot of illustrating themselves. Let's take a look at what your Screamland, your comics, are you still creating those? I know that they were really popular and you enjoyed doing those.
You know, it's, as I mentioned, ever since I was, you know, 8 years old, I think that's when it crystallized in my mind that I wanted to make comics for a living. And then when I was 29, I had my quarter life crisis that I needed to go do it if I was going to do it. So I quit my, what at that point had been a dream job, because really I was fully aware of how incredibly privileged I was to have a full-time job being an illustrator. Those are really hard to come by, where somebody was paying me every day to just make illustrations. But I quit that to go work in comics. And I worked in the Lurkers first with writer Steve Niles, and then on Screamland with Harold Seip. And it was a rude awakening, because especially coming from the publishing world of editorial illustration, just realizing the way that the exchange rate is completely flipped in comics. The amount of income, the amount of pay that you get compared to the amount of work is the exact opposite. So, for example, in illustration, you know, you can, you know, charge, say, $500 for one illustration. When you're doing comics, it's one page of comics, and it'll have six illustrations, and you might get $150. So it's, you know, I kind of think that it's basically five or six times the work for a fifth of the pay.
Sure.
People that go into comics certainly don't do it for the money. People that go into art don't do it for the money.
Okay.
Shouldn't do it for the money, because it's going to be a disappointing ride.
Well, and I do want to mention to our listeners, if you would talk about the premise of Screamland, because I think it's just really a wonderful, comic.
Screamland was the reason why I got really excited about the Screamland is because it was about a lot of things that I love. It's the general premise is about the classic movie monsters from the silver screen, Frankenstein, the Wolfman, the Mummy, and Dracula. And Screamland basically picks up on their story, going on the premise that they were not actors in makeup, but they're actual monsters working in Hollywood, who found a gig and became celebrities in, you know, the 30s and 40s. And then what happened after their the spotlight shifted away from them, they were basically unemployed, washed up, bitter Hollywood have been actors. So Screamland follows on their stories through the 50s, through the, you know, early 2000s, and each monster is doing having a completely different trajectory. For example, the Wolfman has put on so much weight. He's let himself completely go. So he's like 350 pounds of just gross, gnarly, like hairy dude.
That must have been fun for you to draw.
It was really fun to do. And, you know, the Wolfman is just kind of like making a living by, you know, selling like autographs and going through fan conventions and trying to hook up with fans.
Retired in Florida and all.
Frankenstein's retired in Florida. He's just a washed up alcoholic. The Mummy had a brief folk singing career in the 70s, but then with 9/11 had to go underground and had been missing because being immortal and from the Middle East was a really dangerous thing to be. And then Dracula is the only one that had been working steadily ever since. So Screamlight kind of like follows all their stories and brings them all together for like one big story arc.
Really fun. You recently attended Planet Comic Con?
Yes, I was a guest at Planet Comic Con this last weekend. I've been a guest at Planet Comic Con, I think almost every year for the last, I don't know, 8 years or so. It's fantastic. Comic Cons, for anybody that's never been to a Comic Con, it's unlike anything else. And Planet Comic Con has been growing and growing and getting bigger every year. It used to be in the Overland, Park Convention Center. Yeah. It's now at Bartle Hall. So it's great. It's, you know, there's so many people dressed up as superheroes and things.
That's what I missed. I was actually down in that area this past week, and I didn't see anyone walking around. But
yes, the people watching, they were probably all inside, just walking around. Yeah, the people watching is fantastic. And just also the fact that there's so many comics artists, artists in general, but especially comics artists in Kansas City, it's really, really remarkable how... we don't really think, a lot of people may not be aware that there's a ton of people making comics in Kansas City and people that are making mainstream comics that everybody's reading, you know, like people that are doing the big superhero books that are being turned into movies. They live here in Kansas City. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. How many people is that well attended? I mean,
yes, it was
from all over the world. People come to
certainly from all over the country. Yeah, it's I have no idea what the attendance was, but it was pretty mobbed, really busy, especially on Saturday. It was a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday event, and Saturday was just crazy.
So you get to sign and meet fans and just kind of meet other...
Yes, I get to pretend that I'm famous for a second, and I get to like sign autographs and things like that. And then, you know, that only happens at Comic-Cons, and then, you know, real world takes over, and I'm just me changing the litter box. So...
Well, you're down to earth. That's what I like about you. You know, if you want to give our listeners your website or contact information so they can maybe take a look at your work.
Certainly. I have an artist page on Facebook, so that's easy to find Hector Casanova. And then my website is hectorcasanova.com or .net, either one.
.net. We're going to take a real short break, and we'll be right back with ArtSpeak Radio and Hector Casanova and Renee Senderhouse.
American Roots is Alabama bound as we explore the music and culture of the Deep South state that produce musicians as diverse as W.C. Handy, Hank Williams, and the Drive-By Truckers. Find out how stars fell in Alabama and visit Muscle Shoals, birthplace of Southern Soul. I'm Nick Spitzer. We're Alabama bound on American Roots from PRX.
Now, starting a half hour earlier, Wednesday at 7 p.m.
30 millions of people begirding themselves with deadly weapons and falling into antagonistic battle lines. All that was comprehended in one word. War.
The untold story of Irish Wilderness, Missouri, on From Ark to Microchip, Wednesday night at 11:30.
Last week, the Missouri Trade Justice Coalition hosted a forum called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, another corporate power grab. Environmentalists, farmers, unions, and human rights organizations all participated. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll rebroadcast highlights from this event. Tune in Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
And you're listening to ArtSpeak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez-Boyd, here with Hector Casanova and Renee Senderhouse. Welcome back, my friends.
Hi, thanks.
Well, at the break, you were telling me a little bit of something in between the comics and now. What's been going on?
I was just to kind of like loop around to finish the, you know, answering a question about, you know, the comics are, you know, part of my career. After I left the my job as a full-time illustrator and I did comics for 3 years, it was a gradual but inevitable conclusion that I just could not make a living at comics. And I went from having a dream job that was paying great to, you know, working on comics that I loved but being really poor.
Yeah.
So at one point, thankfully, the Star called me about, it was basically a three-year, you know, intermission that I had. And the Star called me out of the blue and asked if I would like my job back because they could really use me. And I said, that's great timing. Let's do it.
And, you know, I can tell you that any number of people that I've talked to and, you know, we were discussing the newspaper, one thing that would come out of the conversations with my folks was that they enjoyed your illustrations. They recognized your illustrations just, you know, without even realizing that, oh, There's his name at the bottom credit.
It's, you know, it was lovely.
'Cause you have a style. Yeah.
It was really lovely working at the Star. It's really lovely doing stuff for the Star for a number of reasons. My favorite thing about it really is that because there's always work, I didn't have to hustle for work. There's always a new project coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to develop several styles. And I would develop, tailor whatever style was most suitable for whatever the particular story was. So I did develop a handful of styles. And people do tell me that there's sort of like a recognizable thread, whether I'm doing the cutesy kind of like children's, you know, more the kid illustration stuff, or the more gritty editorial stuff, that there's apparently there's a recognizable style. It's harder for me to see it, I guess, but I imagine that it's there. It's just my subjectivity and my sensibility shines through. And it was really lovely. It doesn't happen very often. Most of the time when people write in or call into the Stars to complain about things. But occasionally I would get a letter of appreciation.
Terrific.
Or a phone call. Somebody actually telling me like, wow, that was really nice. And those always made my week.
You know, so as an artist, illustrator, and educator, working at the Star and your comics, it's had an impact on you in your lives, but you've been gracious and generous enough to share with the community your talent and your guidance. I want to quote you here from an article that I had read and where you say, in Mexico, being an artist is by definition signing up for a tremendous responsibility in which you are able to communicate through your art visually to the people. You have a responsibility to the people who are voiceless. And so art, just by definition, is a very political act. And I think that's a very powerful statement, and you stand by it today because I should say that you have several projects going on with students working to transform boarded up school buildings in the neighborhood, and let's talk about that, sort of that, those
yes.
projects.
I absolutely stand by that, and you know, it's one of the things, you know, when I first came to the United States, I was a teenager, but people would ask me about culture shock, and I wasn't really even, you know, there's a few things that were jarring, but I wasn't really, at the time, I don't think I would have been able to give a smart answer as to you know, elements of culture shock I would have been experiencing. But as I kind of continue, you know, living here and getting to understand you know, America better. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that has always struck me is that art is seen more as a privilege here, and the way that it just when I grew up, you know, culturally, art always seemed to be more of a responsibility than anything else, and I very much think that. It's not specific to Mexico or the United States, but it's specific to art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of that's why I love teaching, and that's why I love having the opportunity and the honor of being at the Art Institute, is that I'm just one person. Mm-hmm. But now every year I have, you know, 45 of 60 students to whom I can try to kind of pass on this mission and this torch and just this awareness that as an artist, you're signing up for you know, for this role in which you are going to have access to thousands of people's eyes and therefore their brains.
Sure.
And you can affect how people see the world. And to not take that responsibility seriously or at least conscientiously, it seems like such a waste of potential and opportunity.
Right.
I mean, we are here to shape the culture, so let's shape it in a way that is intentional, and we're actually trying to make it better, more intelligent, more responsible, more kind.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the classes that I teach at KCAI is called US, and the class has a dual focus. It's about the collaborative nature of art in general.
Mm-hmm.
So the students do a lot of collaborative projects. And then the other aspect is about the artist's responsibility to society. And that's the class that I, when I started teaching it, I wanted to teach it because I wanted students to, I wanted my students to really work on that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to team up with the Kansas City Public School District and launch a mural project.
Mm-hmm. Is that in the Northeast then?
Yes.
Is it specific to the Northeast, or is it outreach to other communities?
Well, the school that we've been working on is Skerritt Elementary School, which mm-hmm. is in the historic mm-hmm. Northeast. Mm-hmm. And that's the school that we started with because I spent a lot of time trying to find buildings that we could do, mm-hmm. a community beautification project.
Mm-hmm.
And things lined up perfectly so that when I met with the Kansas City Public School District, they had this vacant school that was in the Northeast that had been just attracting really negative attention,
yeah.
tagging
yeah.
and vandalism and just loitering and breaking in and so on. So the residents were becoming really frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been this growing awareness of the benefits that murals can have on a mm-hmm. community. So everything lined up, and the public school district offered us a school building, and that's the building that I use for the class, for the students to paint murals on. It's a gigantic building. It takes up a whole city block, so it's going to take several years to get it all done. But this last fall semester, we covered half of one side of the north side, basically.
How do your students respond to that? Are they willing, or does it sort of open up a whole new idea about the responsibility of art? I mean, is it something that they come prepared with, or do they learn it?
I don't think anybody really was, comes prepared to tackle something like that.
Yeah.
I think that it's the kind of thing that, both the scale, just working on that massive, mural-sized mm-hmm. Artwork. Very few students, if any, had done mm-hmm. anything of that sort mm-hmm. before. And also just the community outreach. We did mm-hmm. a lot of community engagement to get feedback and input from the community. And artists, generally speaking, tend to be introspective
right.
and, socially sort of, hesitant to engage, basically.
Are people in the community excited to see the works of art, and do they have a dialogue with you as you're working?
Yes. The feedback has been tremendous, and just the response from the community mm-hmm. has been tremendous. And that was also another part of the class, is to mm-hmm. make sure that we are we're not just kind of swooping in and
Hey, we're taking over this building.
Exactly. Like,
yeah.
here, let's gonna tell you what you're going to be looking at for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what we wanted to do.
Do you collaborate with the community and what they want, or maybe at helping out painting some of the murals?
We absolutely, the whole premise of the mural and just the way that we had to design it was so that it would be an ongoing dialogue with the community. And as we work on every stage, we always have an open channel of communication so that before we get to the next stage, we have input from the community as to what they want the next set of images to be.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a Facebook page, and we have an email, a Gmail account that mm-hmm. People can write in and give us feedback or ideas. And then we also went door to door, and we just went and spoke to neighbors,
mm-hmm.
Just letting them know about this project, and had a couple community meetings.
Well, it's a very responsible, way to work.
And it was
and
fun.
Makes sense. Yeah.
And it was really fun.
Get to know your neighbors.
It was also, I think, a really great learning experience for students to just, kind of be, like jump into the deep end and realize, like, you have, 4 weeks to do a 30-foot mural. Just do it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get
mm-hmm.
to, like, say, I don't know if I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can, and you do it.
Mm. And as illustrators, I mean, they're used to working fairly small, right?
Relatively small and digitally, and this is the opposite.
Oh, yes, that's true. Very good. We're going to take a real quick music break, and then we'll be right back with ArtSpeak Radio.
si belle que je m'y suis baignée.
Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai.
Sous les feuilles d'un chêne, je me suis fait sécher. Sur la plus haute branche, un rossignol chantait.
Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai.
Chante, rossignol, chante, toi qui as le cœur gai. Tu as le cœur à rire, moi je l'ai à pleurer.
Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai.
J'ai perdu mon ami sans l'avoir mérité. Pour un bouquet de roses que je lui refusais.
Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai.
Je voudrais que la rose fût encore au rosier. Et que mon doux ami fût encore à m'aimer.
Il y a longtemps que je t'aime, jamais je ne t'oublierai.
You're listening to Art Speak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez-Boyd. We have Hector Casanova and Renee Cinderhouse here in the studio live talking about their work as painters, illustrators, and sculptures and installation artists. So I want to welcome back Renee Cinderhouse.
Hi, Maria. Thanks for having me.
You betcha. She's best known for her large-scale immersive installations, mixed media sculptures, and narrative works in clay. As I mentioned, her studio is here in Kansas City. Her sculptures have exhibited extensively through the U.S., most notably at the Carnegie Museum of Art, Scope Miami, Art LA, the Amarillo Museum of Art, and the New Bedford Art Museum. From 2000 to 2008, she was co-director and co-curator of the Green Door Gallery, an acclaimed artist-run exhibition space for emerging artists. Cinderhouse mounted her largest solo exhibition to date, Manifest Destiny, a 2,500-square-foot installation at the Charlotte Street Foundation's La Esquina Gallery in 2012. She was awarded Best Artist of Kansas City in 2005 and 2012 by The Pitch and was awarded Artist Residencies at the Escape to Create program in Seaside, Florida, and most recently Gentel in Banner, Wyoming. So welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Terrific. I also want to mention that you're also the recipient of a National Award in Small Sculpture by National Society for Arts and Letters. That's in case you didn't know. And you've also received two Inspiration Grants and a Creative Capital Professional Development Grant. In your artist statement, you write, "My craft is intensely detailed, oriented, and laborious. My sculptures have their own internal logic and seem to have always existed, discovered complete into themselves, as if they had been born, not made." That's beautiful. It's very poetic.
Well, thanks. And actually, writing is a good bit of my practice. When I was awarded the Escape to Create residency in 2014, even though I am most well known as a visual artist, I actually was a guest as a literary artist. So I was hosted by the wonderful women that run that program, Marcia Dowler and Karen Holland, to pursue writing for the first time in a full-time format. While I was there, though, I also did continue to work on a body of visual work. I'm most interested in creating sculptures and installations within environments. My work is meant to converse with a specific environment in response to it. I really feel that to divorce works of art from the living, breathing world just creates artifice. There's really nothing that we experience in our day-to-day that exists outside of context. And so my work has evolved more and more away from a white box gallery-type presentation, wherein even if I am creating within a gallery or a museum space, I'm also creating an environment within that space for the works to exist in.
Well, and if anyone had truly had experienced Manifest Destiny, you could really understand you know, the way that you work, because you transform that complete space. I didn't realize I was standing in La Esquina. You know.
It was quite an undertaking. It was definitely the largest scale project that we have done, and I am very blessed to have such a wonderful creative community here in Kansas City. It's one of the things that enables me to do the work that I do. Manifest Destiny not only depended on collaboration with my husband, actor Casanova, but also with very close friends of ours, Tyson Schroeder, Rachel Iltz, Nate Bogart, as well as some amazing musical performers and guests that we had highlight throughout the run. The installation really became a stage set in which to tell greater stories that were all thematic to the central concept of the installation.
Very beautiful. You know, I want to ask you how you started off as a ceramicist, right?
Correct.
And how did you evolve from there to an installation artist and so on?
It's interesting. I sometimes think that my artistic process has been myself purposefully getting in the way of the work that I'm best at. Simply because from a young age, I saw how a lot of young artists, in order to be successful, quickly streamline their work into one aesthetic, into that recognizable brand, where before they had really discovered the depth and breadth of their artistic voice, they were making work that quickly became redundant of itself to maintain its sellability and visibility. And for me, the entire point was always about the process and having the truest voice. So even though clay was the most natural medium for me, I mean, starting in grade school, I was lucky enough to be exposed to art classes that had this option. Through college, I always pursued the sculpture department, the mixed media approach. I wanted to master more materials. I wanted to understand the inherent language and connotations of different materials. I really feel that all places and all materials have a built-in history, have their own context and meaning, and to use that history to further the story of the finished work, I think just makes a stronger conversation artistically.
Well, do some artists leave themselves open for criticism by therefore not staying with sort of what they know best? I mean, I remember in art school, you know, a lot of my fellow students were criticized. Well, you know, that work is inconsistent because this is what you do. Do you think that leaves a lot of criticism open for some artists that want to go beyond what they already know what they make?
I absolutely feel that it is a struggle, and it almost puts young artists into a crucial decision-making standpoint where if you want to have an early level of success as an artist to be able to get gallery representation, you're really heavily encouraged to become recognizable, to have your brand, your stamp, your recognizable trademark. And it was something that I was criticized for throughout much of the work I've done. And I really, my comeback to that was that I feel that there is a unifying force at work behind my work. They come from the same basic places. I'm telling the same stories. I have messages within my work. I have themes. I work in series. And whether or not the medium or the presentation is the same, the fundamental flow and undercurrent throughout all the work maintains.
What informs your work? What inspires? What do you draw your work from? I know that's a loaded question, but
and it's,
there's
of course,
so much,
you know, so much that is constantly shifting and evolving. I'm heavily influenced by sciences, by biology, by quantum physics. A lot of my work deals with our current genetic manipulation of our collective inheritance. I talk a lot about our particular relationship to ourselves, and then therefore also to nature and our environment. And I'm also fascinated by how people form memory, how truth is sometimes subjective depending on how people choose to remember their past. We're really all just a summation of our personal stories, and it's the retelling of our personal story as we grow older to ourselves and to each other that creates our personal identity as well as our collective identity as a culture. How those stories are manipulated, rewritten, and reshaped is something that's always been present through all of my work.
Terrific. We're going to take a quick break for some underwriting, and we'll be right back.
Transgender issues in sports on the next Sprouts, Thursday at noon. Fighting Goliath, Part 2. The Growing Resistance to the Tar Sands on Making Contact, Thursday afternoon at 12:30.
And we're back. This is Art Speak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez-Boyd. I'm talking to Renee Sinderhaus here in the studio, along with her husband, Hector Casanova, two of the most creative people that I know that I'll ever meet, I'm sure. Renee, we were talking about your work, and I want to ask you about your Escape to Create experience. What was that like?
That was an amazing opportunity. I had for some time been very interested in attending artist residencies, both nationally and internationally. But because I've built my own studio here in Kansas City, there's always that need and urgency to be here and feeding back into my own practice. Escape to Create was the first residency I was awarded. It was in Seaside, Florida. It was a month-long program in the winter of 2014. And like I mentioned earlier, because writing is a fundamental part of my art practice, one granted that is not as public as my visual art, I was actually awarded the residency to spend that month writing full-time and really collecting a lot of the notes and journaling that existed in my sketchbooks for the last 10 years.
Wow.
And so
wow.
There is some fundamental themes, again, that are present in my sculptures and installation that are first founded in my writing. Mm-hmm. And so an opportunity to revisit years worth of writing and almost be reawakened to the consistency of these themes really helps me shape my future work to have a much more direct message.
So what are some of the themes that you can speak of that might give us a little snapshot of what the work is about from that you created?
Well, for instance, one of the interests I have in residencies is choosing locations that are within a natural environment that are very different than Kansas City. I'm gifted an opportunity, for instance, with Seaside, to be literally oceanside. The ocean was a block and a half from where I stayed, and I spent a great amount of time there. I traveled with some of the porcelain sculptures that I make, which are both cast and then hand-sculpted hybrid forms, typically incorporating human anatomy, figurative base, but also with animal elements, some sort of more dreamlike and allegorical elements, and hybrid forms that create new objects that should immediately look familiar and real to you, and yet shift your perception of the familiar into something new. And I brought these objects, and my intent was to insert them into a new environment, to create a new narrative. So I was that person on the beach with a backpack full of porcelain bones and birds and a camera. And they'd find me climbing around in the dunes and, you know, just at the edge of the protected ecosystem habitats, creating environments for these sculptures to live in. And then I did photo documentation.
I do want to mention to our listeners, ReneeSinderhaus.com, you would be able to see some of the images from that work?
Absolutely, and I must say that in the next couple months, my website will be fully updated with that body of work, as well as I am invited to be a guest at the Gentel Artist Residency Program in
Congratulations.
Wyoming.
Congratulations,
yeah. Thanks, I'm very excited, and I will be starting that residency mid-April, and I will be there through May, and And I'm looking to completely update the website with both residencies, bodies of work. And it'll be a wonderful time to check in on the website come summertime.
Now, when you go to the residency, have you left all your sort of preconceived ideas what you may want to work on? Or do you just sort of go there and go, okay, this is what inspired me and this is where the direction I'm going to take?
Honestly, it's such a hard balance, and I think that that bleeds over even into studio practice.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
At what point do you take your brain out of the mix and say, no, I'm not here to just execute this preconceived idea?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the most formative work, the most important work, comes from a deeper place where you're responding in the moment. And unless you're able to tap into that and really allow that expression to come through, I think art always looks a little stilted. So sometimes I'll go and I'll you know, execute preconceived ideas to kind of warm up, to kind of get that going, to start seeing the conversations that are happening. But then I really try and open it up where I respond to the moment, to that environment. I mean, really, the bottom line is that the work I make in these locations, because they're responding to that specific environment, it could not have been made anywhere else.
Right. It's going to be exciting to see what comes out of that residency in Wyoming.
I'm thrilled. It's, we're up near the Bighorn Mountains on a vast acreage of working cattle ranches, creeks. I'm just absolutely thrilled. I look forward to an opportunity to interact with nature and elements that are either protected ecosystems or carry a land use history that carries back not just decades but through the centuries in this country. And I'm fascinated by the timelessness of those areas.
Wow. What a great journey for you. You know, I want to say your website is ReneeCinderHouse.com, and it's going under construction fairly soon. You said you write a lot.
Correct. Yeah.
Is there any sort of collaboration between you and your husband, Hector, where your words become designs or an image? Or I'm just curious.
Well, we definitely have a very collaborative way of working. I mean, even throughout the years of his Guffman and Godot comic strip, because it was a weekly endeavor, you know, there was mad brainstorming about how neither of us even remotely felt funny. And yet, here we're trying to come up with this concise concept for this to be executed in like five panels.
Yeah.
And, you know, the silliness would ensue, and we'd just start saying the most ridiculous things just to find that core kernel of an idea to execute. And, you know, and I cannot reiterate enough that projects like Manifest Destiny of that scope and scale, although I was fundamentally the driving element of that project, it could never have come to fruition without very tight collaboration and depending on both Hector and other supporters. But fundamentally, if I did not have that support from a designer, an illustrator, somebody who could help me fabricate key elements of the installation, it just would have never... Well, it would have never manifest.
Well, I can certainly say the Manifest Destiny was memorable in my mind. I still can go there in my head and want to touch some of the pieces that I saw, you know, throughout the exhibition.
I just wanted to interject for a second that we have done collaboration stuff, you know, through our lives together. And I was definitely leaning heavily on Renee when I was doing the Guffman and Godot too. You know, just help me come up with regular content for it and tell me if something was funny. And sometimes we would disagree, and I think it's hilarious, and she'd think I was crazy. But I think that the biggest part of our collaboration, aside from the just, you know, individual examples that we could cite, is that all of these concepts about the role of art in society and science and art and interaction, of all of these things they're part of a constant conversation that we've been having ever since we met. And I think that's one of the things that has brought us together, is that we just love the response and the stimulation that you know, anything that I've ever thought about, usually if I run it by Renee, she will find things about it or respond to it in ways that will then allow me to respond to her response, and it'll just elevate the sophistication of whatever it is that we're talking about. It just becomes a lot more interesting and complex.
It helps us hone our own language. I mean, you can be your own sounding board all day long, but unless you have somebody who can understand already the conversation you've been having for over a decade. You know, you're never starting fresh. You can jump right in and then allow the other person to really push to the maximum of their potential.
Well, that's different than the conversation that I had in my head thinking about you two this morning, what it was like in your home. You know, I heard in my head Hector saying, "Renee, look what I made." And Renee's like, "Damn you!" You know, and Renee's like, "Hector, look, you know, look what I did." You know, I mean, is there a competition between the two of you? I mean, a healthy one in terms of, you know, your artist's sensibilities and all.
I think, that, at least for myself, speaking for myself, more than a competition, you know, I think this goes back to that, you know, first question that you asked me, like, you know, when I was a kid, like the first validation, external validation that I started getting as a kid was when I could draw better than, you know, my five-year-old peers. Something that I always, you know, that I tell my students is that if you strive to blow your own mind with your work, you'll always do well. So I always do that. But then I realize that I may be easy to please sometimes, and I want to show the stuff that I do to Renee. And if I can impress her, then I'm really happy. So that's, I think, more than a competition is some sort of codependent need for external validation.
Oh, and it goes further than that, though. I mean, you know, validation aside, it has so much to do with having... Art criticism is a tricky thing. I mean, there's definitely some difficult relationships between art and art critics, artists and art critics. But I get an opinion from somebody I value and trust. I trust their artistic integrity. I trust their eye, and I trust that they will look and find the weaknesses in my work in a way not to tear me down, but only to elevate my practice. So
make it stronger, yes.
Precisely, and having that immediately just, you know, hey, I've been working on this all day. Do you have 5 minutes of your time to help me before I start the next 4 hours of work on this so that I know I'm heading in the right direction is really invaluable.
During the course of the day, are you always sort of looking at each other's work, or at the end of the day, is it just done and you know, are on to something completely different? Just the politics of marriage.
I primarily work in an upstairs studio, and she primarily works in a downstairs studio. I like to think that they're all our studios, but when push comes to shove, we don't get to be in each other's space as much when we're working. And we probably don't see each other's work on a daily basis, but every 3-4 days, you know, we'll kind of visit each other and like just kind of check in with each other and have those kind of conversations, just feedback. Or sometimes it's just, you know, venting or whatever.
Sure.
But we end up having conversations about, you know, when I remember specifically, you know, at one point she asked for my opinion about a sculpture she was working on. And then we kind of start talking about the difference between nudity and nakedness, you know, things like that. But it's, it's more like, you know, twice a week or so we'll, you know, kind of seek each other's advice or feedback on whatever we're working.
So let me ask you, do you have any advice or words of wisdom for people who are in the arts that you might want to impart them with?
This is for you. Take it.
Both of you, either one of you. What would you say to someone who's starting out as an illustrator or beginning to work in ceramics?
I think that thing that I just mentioned a little minute ago is probably the one thing that I can always rely on as a kind of like a foolproof way to make it as an artist is do not, you know, don't do it for money, as we said earlier. Like, never go into art for money.
Right.
That's just going to be disappointing. And don't do it for external validation. If you try to always strive to impress yourself and to blow your mind and surprise and delight yourself with what you're making, and also have high standards, obviously, like, don't be, you know, easily satisfied with your own work, but strive to keep on surprising how good can you possibly make this. If you always strive for that, I think that everything else will fall into place.
I think that one of the hardest things to maintain once you transcend the moment of doing art because you love it to deciding you're going to do art because this is what you want to do as a full-time endeavor is losing track that art itself is a journey. It is precisely based in the process of becoming. And you start wanting to fast forward to an end goal, to the point where you're successful, the point where you're a full-time artist, the point where it's sustaining you with income. And you start divorcing yourself from the most important part of the making. And so I find a lot of people get destination-oriented. Art isn't about, you know, living in the brand-name city.
Yeah,
it's not right. about living next door to the famous guy. It's about building a studio, a community, a place that is sustainable for your practice. We've chosen to stay and live in Kansas City for over a decade, approaching almost two now. It's kind of crazy to say. Simply because Kansas City enables us to be the artists that we're trying to be. And we wouldn't be able to do this in another city.
Promise me you'll never move to another city.
I miss the ocean.
Well, I can certainly do that. And I say that tongue-in-cheek because, you know, you've brought such a vitality to the city with your work and with your work in the community. So, you know, thank you so much. Is there anything that that I've missed that you might want to mention, an upcoming project or event?
Well, since I'm teaching right now, I don't mm-hmm. really have any upcoming projects other than...
Renee's like, what?
I'm going to Flatstock, which is part of South by Southwest. It's a music poster
festival. You're leaving tonight,
festival.
Aren't you?
I'm leaving tonight. Yeah. I have many loves in art, illustration mm-hmm. as a broad category, but murals, comics, and music posters is mm-hmm. One of the things that I love. So there's a music poster festival happening in Austin.
Perfect.
So I'll be heading there tonight. Later in the summer, I'll be working on another mural that is being, the city commissioned me to do a mural, so I'll be working on that as well.
Beautiful.
And teaching at KCI.
Please promise me that you'll come back on
We'd
the program.
Love to. Thank
oh,
you so
I'd be
much
honored
for,
to be back.
Great. For hosting. It's a wonderful program. We're honored to be here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
Many thanks to Hector Casanova and Renee Cinderhouse. I want to let our listeners know that next week I'll be talking with Michael Baxley, Consuelo Cruz, Bryce Dyer from the Belcher Arts Center. That's next Wednesday, March 25th. Please stay tuned for Afternoon Jazz with Jeff Harshbarger at 3 p.m. Old G's Hangout with Groovy Grant at 6 p.m. Interfaith Voices, 7 o'clock American Roots, and 9 o'clock Chamber Music with Dr. Mike or Mark Andrus. This is Maria Vasquez Boyd. I want to say thank you all for listening, and honey, I'm coming home.